Baseball fans everywhere. My name is Michael LeColin, also known as the Brooklyn Trolley Blogger, and I welcome you back to the Metsian Podcast. The converted Mets fan, Sam Maxwell, is not able to join us this evening. My other partner, Rich Spirago, is available. Hello, welcome. How are you, my friend?
Doing well, Mike. It's a nice off night after a 2-3 in Cincinnati, and have the Yankees on. It's kind of a stress-free evening with no Mets baseball, so I'm doing well. Thanks.
Very good, very good. You know, the last six games were, in one form or another, a lot of fun. You know, some of the results didn't go quite to our satisfaction, but a lot of drama, and we're going to get into that with our featured guest this evening, Mr. John Coppinger. Hello, and welcome back. Thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you guys for having me. It's always a pleasure, and I'm looking forward to discussing some Mets topics with you guys.
Well, here we are. We're back from the break. A couple of things. I want to lay the foundation of this evening's discussion. For the listeners, tonight's menu, we're going to go through each and every game of this road trip that was the series against the Pirates and the series against the Reds. Then we'll get into some individual topics. We'll talk about Jacob DeGrom, Michael Conforto, perhaps some Stroman and Edwin Diaz. We'll talk the trade deadline. We'll talk the injured list. And what are we going to do next? So that being said, the Mets are presently 50-43, 7 games over 500. They're 9-8 in July. They're in first place by 3.5 games over Philadelphia. The last time we spoke on this podcast, Philadelphia was at 500. Today, they go into this evening's game against Atlanta, 500. So there's that. And then there's this. The Mets, we know they've been scoring, low amount of runs. They're second in the National League. Second least in runs scored. But they're also second least in runs allowed. So there's that. And one last thing I will say, and Rich, this is going to sound familiar to you. I'll keep pointing to that 7-game winning streak in May. Because here we are on July 22nd, 7 games over 500. You can interpret that in a number of different ways. One is to say, take that winning streak away, and they're a 500 team. Or, you could stay on the side of positivity and continue calling this team resilient and tough. So I will start with you, my friend. I want Mr. John Coppinger to formulate his opinions and his opening statement. So, Rich, let's pick it up. Here we are in the second half. A series against Pittsburgh, a series against Cincinnati. What say you?
What say me? I think what you saw over the last six games is kind of indicative of who this team is. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. As currently constructed, they have most of the lineup on the field, but now they're decimated in the pitching ranks. So as currently constructed, they're probably a team that's a slightly over 500 team, and that's the way they played, Mike, because you said it. In early May, they beat Colorado and Baltimore. They won their 7 in a row. Good. They beat a bunch of bad teams like they're supposed to. I think I was talking about last time that when they played teams over 500 going into the All-Star break, they were 8-10. So the Reds were over 500 for this series. So if you go 2-1 there, you're talking about 10-11. So this is basically a team, in my opinion, that is slightly better than average. Somewhat, we'll give them like a B, a solid B. They're not a great team. They're not even a very good team, but they're not a bad team. And right now, that being a somewhat above average is enough to be in first place. And that's what this team is. You know, yeah, they'll disappoint you against the Pirates, and you'll want to pound your head against the wall. And I think I actually did. You know, so they'll disappoint you there, but then they'll turn around and go to Cincinnati, a team that could mash, and they'll beat them 2 out of 3. This team is doing exactly what teams like this do. They give you a roller coaster ride. And that's what I think. And that's why, that will change if they should get DeGrom back and they get Carrasco. Well, now maybe they go from being a slightly above average team to a genuinely above average team. But I think we're getting exactly what this roster is structured at this point, through nobody's fault, most of your injuries, but exactly what this roster should be giving you, that's what they're giving you. That's my opinion.
Very good. John, it's been the ongoing conversation now. Are the Mets this good, or is the division this bad? Like I said, the Phillies are at 500. Atlanta and the Phillies play tonight. So the Mets' 3.5-game standing is going to change one way or another. So what say you?
I certainly think it's a little of both. What struck me this week is when they, I believe it was Fangraphs that put out their playoff odds. And even though the Mets were 2-3 games ahead of the Phillies, the Phillies' playoff odds were about 45%, while the Mets' playoff odds were something like 18%. And the reasoning, as a lot of people put it, was, well, the Phillies have an easier schedule. They have the Diamondbacks and the Rockies coming up, whereas the Mets have already played these games. Fair. But the Phillies still have to win those games. And the Phillies, the Phillies are 7-6 against the Marlins. So I say that that's fair, they have to win those games. Now, from the Mets standpoint, I think it's very interesting that you talked about the 7 games that they beat Colorado and Baltimore, and they're 7 games over 500. But I also look at another group of 7 games, and that's the 7 games they played against the Padres. You're talking about a team, not the only team, but a team that's considered the class of the National League, and they beat them 4 out of 7. So while I think Rich is correct, this is a slightly above average team, but it's also a team that shows you that they could play with teams that are good. I don't think they've shown that. I don't think the mediocre teams of the past few years have shown that they can do that. This team has shown that they can do that. And this team has also shown that if they get those reinforcements, if they're ever 100% healthy, that they can do some damage. Now, the other question is this. When the Mets were 62-63 in 2015, they went and swung a trade for Yoenis Cespedes. And after they swung that trade, we all know what happened. It propelled them to the World Series. Does this team seem better than that team that was 62-63? And if so, then they deserve that chance to go for it. I think the players in that room have shown that they deserve this front office going out and getting them somebody, whether it's, and I'm sure we'll get into it later, but whether it's a bat like Bryant, a reliever like Kimbrel, or even a starter like Hendricks, I think that they've proven that if they can swing a deal for any or all of the three, that's going to make teams like the Padres and Dodgers and Giants sweat a little bit.
Any of all or all of the three. Wow. Wow. I will also throw this out. I don't want to sell the Mets short. They also had a 5-game streak to end the month of May. And presently, there's 6 teams in the National League with a positive run differential. The Mets are one of them. 3 of them come from the West. 2 of them come from the East. The Mets and the Braves. 1 from the Central. Milwaukee. So there's that. So, gentlemen, let's rewind back to Friday, Game 1 against Pittsburgh. Not the optimal way to kick off the second half. Pittsburgh loss, win. And bears noting that Pittsburgh is indeed the last place team in the Central, and they have the second least wins in the National League, and the Mets just have to do better. So getting back to Friday's game, Game 1 of this series, couple of highlights, and you guys just take it wherever you will. I will only say I'm a little disappointed. Mets got three hits. One run, I can live with. But three hits, that's something that sticks in my craw. Marcus Stroman pitched well, effectively, but he looked a little early in the fifth inning. Perhaps a little tweak. Obviously, his next performance, you know, eliminated any doubt or suspicion that we may have had insofar as his health. But in game one against Pittsburgh, that was a good appearance. But again, those three hits really stick in my side, and I was perturbed over that. That's not the way I wanted to start the second half. So game one, Pittsburgh, Friday night. Take it away, Rich.
Yeah, you know, after 5 days of no Mets baseball, I think we were all as a fan base really energized. You know, you have a first place team. You know, they kind of in the last series against the Pirates, splitting it. They're like, okay, we'll go into Pittsburgh. At minimum, they're going to take 2 out of 3. We're all excited. We're all revved up. And quite frankly, Mike, you know, I don't know what more to say about that game other than it looked like they were still at the All-Star break. You know, they looked like they were asleep half the game. You know, three hits like you're talking about. They did have, you know, several runners on base. They left some guys on base in that game. You know, no shock there if you've been a Mets fan, unless you're new around here, right? They left a lot of runners on base. They, you know, they had first and second in an inning, and they would have, you know, first and second one out, first and second no outs, and you keep thinking, okay, this is the breakthrough. They're going to blow the doors off this game, and just nothing happened. And, you know, Stroman was effective, like you said. The rain delay probably has something to do with it, albeit it was brief. It was like 40 minutes. That probably impacted his night. So it's like, okay, you know, this didn't feel good. They got the pitching, the good pitching from Stroman that we've come to expect and from all the starters, really. So, okay, great. But it's the same old crap, you know, that they left a lot of guys on base, only three hits. I believe, was that the game they were 0-for-12 with runners in scoring position? And it's like, what are you doing? You know, this is not the first place team that I root for. But what's happening here? And it was just, I don't know, I left that game feeling, you know, what was that? I mean, it wasn't a game that aggravated me. I don't know about you guys, but it was just more like, what? 0-for-12 with runners scoring position against the Pirates and three hits and you had 5 days off, and what in the hell's going on? That was my reaction to that game.
Yeah. John, just one hit over the final four innings, and that was the last we saw of Francisco Lindor.
Yeah, that was the start of the beginning of the end for Lindor's season thus far. But what bothered me about that game, I'll play on something that Rich said about not getting, only having three hits all game, and what you said about the three hits all game. They've had games like that before. They've had games like that this season. They've lost to some very good pitchers, and they've lost to some very mediocre pitchers who had great nights. I go back to Garrett Richards of the Red Sox, who was dazzling that day, that night, at Citi Field against the Mets. But that night they faced Chad Kuhl, who had nothing, absolutely nothing. Couldn't find the strike zone. His stuff was wild in the strike zone. And the Mets, I thought offensively that was by far the worst night of the season for that reason, is that they couldn't hit a pitcher and they couldn't wait out a pitcher who had no control and no stuff. That's what bothered me about that game. And honestly, it worried me. It worried me for going forward for the rest of the season.
That's a great point, because Chad Kuhl did indeed walk 5 batters that game, and the Mets faced, 5 relievers and mustered little to nothing. So let us move on to Saturday now. The Mets lose again 9-7. This is the game that the Mets were winning 6-0 after 7 innings, and then the roof caved in. Rich? And you made that very well known. Pick it up.
Yeah, you know, it was like, so you lose both games, but the emotions, at least for me, were entirely different. I walked away just kind of scratching my head Friday, but Saturday it's like, okay, you know, you can have a bad game, like John said. You know, you've been a Met fan for a while. You know that they have this history of, making these nondescript pitchers look like Cy Young. Okay, it happened again. Fine, move on. 6-0 lead. Okay, you're sitting back. You know, this is what's supposed to happen. They're beating the Pirates 6-0. They're going to kick them in the pants and say, look, we're much better than you are. We're going to win tonight. Then we're going to blow you out tomorrow. This was in my head, of course. And that'll be that. We'll walk out of here 2 out of 3. Okay, Seth, please take care of these guys. You know, make it kind of quick. I got to go to bed here. And Diaz, you know, just not take care of it. Well, you know what? They had a 6-0 lead. They had the game set up with those guys rested. And when you lose that game, you don't know what to say, because at least when they had the 5-0 lead against the Pirates on the Sunday game before the break, the Pirates had 8 at-bats to come back. This, they did it in an inning. They did it in 2 innings. And it's like, and against Diaz and Lugo. And it's like, it just became, it was such an aggravating loss. It was stunning on the one hand. It was aggravating on the other. And you know, and I'll make the point before you segue over to John. It kind of made it worse that the hit percentage, that the probability of the ball that the Stallings hit, the probability of that ball being a hit was 3%. You know, they do that on I think it's Baseball Savant, based on launch angle and exit velocity. It had a 40-degree launch angle with a 95 exit velocity, which, you know, means fly ball or pop up, really, in most cases. And the ball gets out of the ballpark for a grand slam to end the game. So you put all that together, and it's like, that to me was the sky was falling. It's like, you know, there's something cosmic going on here. The gods are now really taking it out on the Mets, because that was a series of events that really should not have happened. An implosion from Lugo, implosion from Diaz. Yes, we've seen that in the past. A ball that went out that, you know, that had a 3% chance of being a hit, and it's a grand slam home run. It's like, how can you put all that together and then lose the game to that team in that setting? It was unfathomable. That's my take on that one.
Yeah, this indeed was one of the more ponderous losses of the season. And Rich, I'm glad you brought up Edwin Diaz. I'm glad you brought up Seth Lugo. As you say, I couldn't have said it better. Two implosions. So it's worth noting. But I will also say, you know, I wanted to stand up and clap for Tyler McGill. 6 innings, no runs, 2 strikeouts. Good for him. On another positive note, Michael Conforto, 2 doubles, perhaps a portent of things to come. So, John, your impressions of game 2.
Well, they scored the 6 runs, so that was good. After the night they had the night before, that was a positive sign. And this was really the start of their good hitting streak. You know, we've all wondered where the offense has been. The offense showed up in these 6 games, or in the 5 games after that first disaster against Cool. But the second game, and I'm not one to complain about managers every day. There are some people that do it, and they really scrutinize what the manager does and go through everything with a fine-tooth comb. I'm not one to do that. But that loss, that Saturday's loss, to me, was on Rojas. Lugo was terrible. Diaz did not have his stuff in the ninth, but it should have never got to the ninth. Lugo's first 4 batters in the eighth at 6-0 were 3 batters that he started off with a 2-0 count. And the other batter, I think it was Nagowski, that had a first-pitch double. So 4 batters, 1 first-pitch double, 3 other 3 batters started 2-0 counts. How does Seth Lugo get four more batters after that? How do you not know that he doesn't have it that night? They brought in Loop only after the Defoe home run made it 6-5. So, you know, as a friend of mine likes to say, Rojas is really good at closing the barn doors after the horses have already escaped. And that was a perfect example. So that was, so it should have never gotten to Edwin Diaz with a 1-run lead in the ninth. Now, that said, Edwin Diaz has got to put that game away. He didn't do it. The pitch to Stallings made a good swing on, and I give him all the credit in the world. But everything leading up to that, you saw Diaz didn't have his control. He wasn't quite there. So, yeah, it is concerning. I think Diaz is going to get it back. I hope he's going to get it back. I hope it's not proven that he's one of those Spider Tech guys Spider-Tac guys that that now all of a sudden has lost his control. But I think he's going to get it back. But I put that particular loss on Rojas.
Very good. So let us move on to Sunday. And all I can say is, wow, the Mets turned the table. The Mets were losing 6-0 after the first inning. And then, well, we all watched or heard or found out about it one way or another. Rich, again, I'm going to expose you. You were taking you were laying odds on Twitter about their win probability, and you started at 5%.
You know, that was the game that really got my goat. Now, Saturday night was a warm-up, and the first inning in that game, you know, and to me, cliche coming, but I don't mind – nobody minds physical errors. It happens. You guys are human beings. But when Walker vapor locked on that ball and became more interested in arguing with the umpire than with, you know, realizing that the Pirates were having a merry-go-round around the bases, that – I was like, that really put me over the top, because it's like, you know what? We've all learned that in Little League, no matter what, if you're playing basketball, football, baseball, in the sports that have whistles, play until you hear a whistle. Don't stop. Baseball, play until there's a call. Don't worry about arguing with the umpire while the ball's in play. It's all of those things. And it was that got me. I don't give a damn that the Pirates scored 6 runs in the first. That's going to happen. It's baseball, right? These guys are major league players. The way they scored those runs was beyond infuriating. It was a self-inflicted wound. All right, so now you have the 6 runs in the first inning. But, you know, then the way they came back and won the game kind of epitomized the entire 2021 season. Travis Blankenhorn had the hit of the day. That's the hit that put them back in the ball game when he hit the 3-run home run. Who the hell is Travis Blankenhorn? Well, who's Mason Williams? Who's Jaswani Fargas? Who are these guys? But that's, and you know, who's Billy McKinney, who's now a Dodger? That's how the Mets were winning when things were going well. They were getting these contributions. It was the next man up. It was, you know, unsung heroes, guys you never heard of, Jake Hager. It was the 2021 Mets epitomized. Never say die. Contributions from guys you don't expect. And, you know, I'm going to pat myself on the back. In the bottom of the eighth, I tweeted, how ironic would it be if, of all people, Michael Conforto got the big hit? I just had a feeling that he was going to find a way. I don't know why, but you know, he had been so cold that this would be his moment, and he did. I mean, you know, he got that pitch from Rodriguez. He pumped it. When Dom Smith got the hit, it was like, okay, come on, Michael, you know, this is your time, because you've been cold. This is the time to really, really not only get hot, but really help the team. And he did it. And it just felt like everything we've come to love about the 2021 Mets wrapped up in that one game. Did it make up for losing 2 out of 3? Not all the way, but the way they won it made up a good bit of that distance. So it was just an interesting game, and it was a great win.
That was exciting. Michael Conforto's home run. That was fun. Tawan Walker, unfortunately, he couldn't make it out of the first inning. 4 hits, 4 walks. I mean, obviously his worst outing of the season. But kudos to the bullpen. 5 pitchers, no runs. Good stuff. John, what say you?
Well, first off, I want to commend Rich for going through that whole first inning with Tawan Walker and not once mentioning David Cone in Atlanta. I commend you for that. Number two, I miss Billy McKinney already. I'm actually surprised that he's gone. And number three, I didn't tweet anything at all that game because I was in a state where if I had tweeted something, I probably would have regretted it. You know, that's when they went down 6-0 after the first, I thought, man, this is a direct extension of the previous night. And it's not usually the case. You know, we all talk about that. Oh, what a bad loss. It's going to be bad momentum. And usually it doesn't really come past. But I thought for that first inning it did. That was the quintessential hangover, bad loss hangover, that first inning. And I was actually shocked that Rojas lost his mind after that. It was a correct call by the umpires. I'm shocked, and I thought that argument was pure frustration. I know people are framing it as, oh, he got his players fired up. I didn't think that it was that at all. I thought he lost his mind. I thought he was frustrated. And I don't blame him for being frustrated. But that's, man, for everybody that says Rojas is a cool customer no matter what, I mean, take a look at that tape. Take a look at that playback. That's you know, because he was frustrated. And listen, did it? I don't think it was intentional that he got his guys fired up. But if that was the effect that it had, God bless, it worked. And like you said, the bullpen was outstanding. When it got to 6-5, I was thinking, man, this is what the Mets do. They make that comeback and they fall just short. Man, it would be a shame if that Taijuan Walker play was the margin of difference in that game after they lose 6-5. But Conforto, man, he loves, you know, the Mets love Great American Ballpark. They seem to find their stroke in parks like this and Minnesota and Arizona. They seem to find their stroke in those places, especially Cincinnati. But Pittsburgh too. They seem to find their stroke in Pittsburgh also. You know, that's a decent hitting park. So when Conforto hit that, I was honestly shocked. I gave up on the game. I gave up, and they came back and they won it. And that's what the Mets do, and that's what they've done all season.
Let's go Mets! On that play that Luis Rojas blew a gasket. If anyone was watching, do you think that ball was off the batter's foot or shin, Rich?
That would be the only reason, obviously, that it would have been foul, because it was clearly on the line when it was touched. I know, Mike, I've watched the replay a few times. I can't really tell if it made contact with the batter or not. But I'll tell you what. If we, having the benefit of replay, at least I can't say definitively that that's what I saw, there's no way Taijuan Walker saw it. And just, you know, arbitrarily assuming it's foul and knocking it away and then arguing while the Pirates are running the bases, you know that ball's in play, at least at the moment. And what are you doing? What are you doing? And so, yeah, I don't know if it hit him or not, but that would be the only reason that I would think that they thought it was foul. But how could Rojas see that? I mean, if it nicked something, how could he have seen that from the dugout? I don't know.
You know, either way, I think John brings up a great point. Sometimes you just got to flip over the buffet table. John, any last opinions about that play?
I did not notice. I wasn't even thinking about the ball hitting the foot, and nobody seemed to bring it up. So like Rich said, if he couldn't see it after the first couple of glances, and if nobody else could see it after the first couple of glances, I don't expect replay to overturn that. I mean, they've screwed up more obvious calls than that, so I certainly wouldn't have any faith that they would overturn something based on that.
Agreed, but that's what I believe I saw. Anyway, let's take a moment out. John, please, tell us what you're doing, where we can do it, a.k.a. Mr. Domus. What's going on?
Oh, sure, absolutely. Well, I'm still at www.metsfordomusblog.com. I have to step away from my Alexa or else she'll go or else she'll start talking, but there is a sports talk app on Alexa that you can download on Sunday nights at 6 o'clock for Sports Talk New York, and I'm the first 5 minutes of that basically. So everybody go ahead and do that. And then every once in a while, we still do the Burger Ball podcast, and we're overdue for that. So that's where you guys can find me.
And Rich, what do you got going on?
Well, my basic Mets stuff is this, and also with Metsmerized Online, I focus on the history pieces, and I can't wait to talk about one that published today, which will be very topical to where you're going next. So thank you, Mike. It's Metsmerized, and of course, this podcast with you and Sam.
And again, my shameless plug, Brooklyn Trolley Blogger. Been spending a lot of the summer recapping Negro League baseball games, particularly the Brooklyn Royal Giants. And more particular to that, John Donaldson, who I believe belongs in the Hall of Fame. 1918 was his lone season with the Brooklyn Royal Giants. And with the help of the Donaldson Network, I'm trying to help him promote that idea. So, gentlemen, let's get back into baseball. Cincinnati. Very interesting. Win, loss, win. Exciting ball. And we see Michael Conforto heating up. He had those two doubles. He has that home run, you know, under his belt. Now we go into Cincinnati. Game one on Monday, 15-11. Pitching be damned. Mets 18 hits, Cincinnati 16 hits. A lot to talk about in this game. So, Rich, take it away. A lot of pitchers in this box score. So a lot to talk about. We started with an opener, Jared Eichhoff. I'm sure he's a topic of conversation. But six other pitchers after him. What say you?
You know, it was just – here's my shameless plug for the article. It for a lot of – not a lot of the same reasons, but in terms of how bizarre it was, it reminded me of the 1986 game that the Mets played in Cincinnati where Orozco and McDowell played the outfield and Carter played third and the fight with Ray Knight and Eric Davis. So that was the one – that's the article I was mentioning. But this particular game, there's so much to unpack. You know, I could talk about it for half an hour. I'm going to try to do it in a minute. Eichhoff, they start Eichhoff. Well, you know what? No. I mean, how many times do we have to see Jared Eichhoff out there to realize that as we get deeper into the season – it's not a tenable strategy to keep DFAing this guy to make a roster spot. Then when nobody claims him, bring him back, throw him out there to start a game, have him get pounded, DFA him. You know, you can't do this, okay? You had to do it maybe earlier on in the season. Okay, fine. But now you're a legitimate contender, and that's not a strategy going forward. That's the first thing. Well, they get a nice lead, and Eichhoff gives it right back. Okay. Then they go down 7-3, and then they start the chipping away. The home run start, Conforto, Smith, right? Earlier in the game, you had Pete and McNeil. The never-say-die Mets, you know, they come back from a 7-3 deficit. But then what happens? Well, they have the lead in the eighth inning. They take the lead for the first time since the first inning, they take the lead. Great. This is going to be a game where, you know, the never-say-die Mets took the lead. They're going to win it. Well, what happens in the bottom of the ninth? I want you guys to comment on this. I have no idea why Luis Rojas did not walk Winker. Yes, I know you're putting the winning run on base. The kid batting behind Winker, I think, had a .213 average, a very light hitting infielder. You have to throw the book out the door there and say, I am not letting their best hitter, he and Votto, I'm not letting one of their best hitters beat me. Go to first base, dude. I'm pitching to this guy. You've got to do it. And if that kid, that .213 hitter, his name escapes me, if he hit the ball up the gap and they score two runs and the Reds win, you could easily defend that decision. So that the intrigue there. And I think as Mets fans, at least I was, I'm like, okay, Winker's going to get the hit. I just hope it stays in the ballpark and then can play the 10th inning. But to me, it was a foregone conclusion he was going to get the hit. And he did. So he gets the hit, and now the game goes to extra inning. All right, fast forward. Mets score. They bring in Banda, right? Nobody even knew who this guy was. Yeah, they picked him up from the Giants earlier in the year. Okay. Looks like he's 12 years old. He's unable to hold the lead. Fine. You kind of expected that. Now you go to the 11th, but there were so many little things in that game. The Reds in the bottom of the 10th had first and second no outs after they tied the game. It looked like, for all the world, this game is over, brother, right? Well, he gets the double play ball. And what happens on that double play ball? Jose Peraza breaks his finger, but he still turns a double play. We didn't know that till the next day. All right, Mets, so the two huge outs, then they get out of the inning. Remember also that with a man on second and two outs, that ball that was hit into the left field corner that went foul, that was basically up against the wall, and Pilar, you know, made the heroic effort after. But that ball's foul. That ball lands a couple feet the other way. Game over, right? Well, that doesn't happen. Well, Mets go out there in the 15th, and they score the run, and then lo and behold, Pilar hits the three-run home run. Conforto hits a solo jack, 15-10. But let's not forget this. Let's not forget that it was 15-11, and they brought Trevor May in to try to get the save, pitching on his third consecutive day, and he got the 3-2 on that same guy. His name escapes me, the guy, the light-hitting infielder, and he got the 3-2 on that guy. If he walks that guy, he was one pitch away from doing that, Votto comes up as the tying run at the plate against the tired Trevor May. Who knows what would have happened? I was on the edge of my seat. That game was not over. So there was so much in that game. You forget about Eichhoff that he started the game. But, yeah, he did, and we have to think about that. You forget Howie Rose made a great point. I think it was the bottom of the seventh or the bottom of the eighth. I don't remember which it was, where the Reds had second and third, ground ball to the infield. I think it was a short. And let's not forget Guillorme's tough day. Pete made an incredible scoop on a ball, like a Keith Hernandez-ish scoop. If he doesn't scoop that, it goes by him. If he kicks it, two runs score. We never have this conversation about the 11th inning. There was so much in that game, guys, so much. You forget about these little things that happen in the middle innings because it seems like it was, you know, like a year ago. It was just it wasn't a good game because it wasn't a well-played game, and it was full of angst. And I know I talked to a lot of Mets fans the next day. They said they were mentally exhausted. They woke up tired from that game because you were mentally exhausted after all that went on. So anyway, that's my take.
Four errors by the Mets in that game. John, I have a saying, once it is an event, twice is a coincidence, three times is a trend. And now Mike Conforto, like I said, he has a game with two doubles, home run, and now this game with two home runs. He's somewhat carrying the team, and that's my biggest knock against him, that he's never done that through his years with the Mets. And, you know, this being his contract year, he needs to demonstrate that a lot more often. And he's running out of time. But pick it up where you will.
Oh, agreed on that. You know, we were spoiled by watching Darryl Strawberry all those years, seemingly taking the team on his back in certain stretches, certainly in 88 and definitely in 1990, where, and don't forget, that was a contract year for him. And Strawberry put the team on his back a lot that year and almost single-handedly dragged that carcass to the division title. So I think we all expected Michael Conforto to do the same thing. He had the injury that kind of delayed his start a little bit, but he's put up some pretty good numbers the last few games. So maybe this is the turning point for Conforto going forward, or maybe it's just playing against some bad pitching in Pittsburgh and in that ballpark in Cincinnati. We'll see, because it's going to be some. This is going to be a key six-game stretch. We're going to see how these guys do against Toronto. We're going to see how these guys do against Atlanta. As for the game, I believe Mike Freeman is the name that's been escaping you, Rich. I know it was Freeman because
yes.
I kept thinking, well, thank God this isn't Freddie. You know, this is Mike. So,
there you go.
So that was the guy. And something else you didn't mention also that I would like to, and you did such a great job recalling all those small details, but I thought another key, and not just because of what he did in the game, but pinch hitting James McCann for Tomas Nito. You know, McCann comes on and he hits the two-run homer to give the Mets the lead, and then he gets another go-ahead RBI in the 10th inning. So yeah, him coming in, his performance was key. But what manager in their right mind, how often do you see a manager pinch hit their second catcher for their first catcher, especially in the middle of the game, and risk having an injury to your second catcher when you don't have a third, when you have to go to your emergency catcher, especially when both hitters, both Nito and McCann are right-handed? It seemed like such an arbitrary decision. I mean, the only thing I could think of was that, well, there was a left-hander in the game, and McCann's numbers against lefties are better than Nito's numbers against lefties. So perhaps I thought that was the reason, but it just, on every level, on almost every level, that decision, by the backup manager, by the way, Dave Jouse, made no sense whatsoever. But it led to three key runs, and that's just where you just say, you know, you throw up your hands and say, all right, I trust you. It worked. I'm not even going to argue it. And kudos to Anthony Banda, because like you said, Rich, at first and second after the hit that tied it, that game was over. I'm just looking for a quick end to that point. Now I want to go to sleep. I want to write my blog and go to sleep, and that's it. But give him credit. He got the job done. And also, too, with that game, a key managerial decision that the Reds made that trumped the bad decision that the Mets made to not walk Winker in the ninth. Jeff McNeil's up with a runner in scoring position, and Banda's up next, and there's nobody, no position player left on the Mets bench. And I don't know if the Reds realize that. That's a place where you've got to walk McNeil. and force Banda to come up. And then if Pilar beats you after that, so be it. But at least he comes up with two outs at that point and the game tied instead of already being ahead by one. Maybe the pressure's on a little bit if that's the case. But you got to walk Jeff McNeil when you know that Banda or another pinch-hitting pitcher has to come up. And that was another key moment in that game as well. Thankfully for the Mets that somebody outmaneuvered the stupid from the Mets side with their own bigger stupid.
Great point. Great point, John. Forgotten about that.
Excellent.
And not to mention, when Banda did come up later in the game, he hit the ball really hard. But anyway, but that's a great point you made.
Great points by both of you gentlemen. Excellent recall about that game. So much in that game. Let us move on. Now, Tuesday, that's loose. 4-3. Sad. Unfortunate. Take it away, Rich.
You know, that game was kind of like, I don't know. As I think about it, it also kind of epitomized the bad of 2021, whereas the previous game and the game against Pittsburgh on Sunday epitomized the good of 21, never say die, unsung heroes, all of that. This game, freak injury, right? Robert Stock, who actually, at least he has major league stuff. You know, he might not have been that successful in his limited time in the major leagues, but he has major league stuff. I'd much rather have him out there than Eichhoff. So it's like, okay, you know, let's see what this kid is. Okay, fine. But what happens? He tweaks his hamstring running out a ground ball, and he's gone. And then, you know, it's like, oh, my God, here's the bad 2021. So you have that. And so as I think about that game, I think more about all the balls the Mets hit hard, particularly Conforto, in that game that found gloves. So, you know, it was kind of like a teeth grinder because they had traffic on the bases in that game. And it wasn't like the Friday game in Pittsburgh where they looked feeble. They actually hit the ball hard, again, particularly Conforto, and they just happened to find gloves, and it's just a frustrating way. And then with Stock going down, they had to cobble it together. I remember thinking, and I know that this is where we're going next, but I remember thinking, my God, the bullpen ate, you know, almost eight innings the night before. I think it was eight innings the night before. And now this, it was eight and eight more innings in this game or seven. And it's like, now there's no bullpen left, another freak injury. So while we were starting to feel good, the good 2021 was coming back. This was all the bad from 2021 kind of wrapped into one game with, you know, another injury, a further depletion of the bullpen. And in this case goes beyond 2021. If you've been a Mets fan for a long time, hitting in hard luck. So that was this game for me.
To me, this game is somewhat of a microcosm of the Mets' condition. Look at who the Mets had on the mound for them. You know, yeah, Robert Stock had to leave after the first inning. But after that, we go with Nagasek, Diaz, Hartley, Loop, and Smith. Not household names, really. And you look at the injured list, you know, we have DeGrom on there presently, David Peterson, Lucchesi, Kesselman, Yamamoto, Betances, and others. So I think this is somewhat, it's a game that really prioritizes where the Mets' mind could and should be entering the trade deadline. Throughout all these five games that we've discussed so far, third base has not come up once. So, John, wherever you want to take this.
This is a weird one. Like you said, Stock goes down after one inning, and they've got a patch yet again. And the Mets almost won this game, too. They almost came back. You know, it goes to show the great job that this bullpen has done all year, and it doesn't matter who they throw in there. Now, this goes back to something I was talking to you guys about before the call, but I was surprised Nagasek only went three innings. Because he batted after his second inning with runners on. And I was talking to a friend of mine, and we were like, all right, well, if you're going to bat him, if you're not going to pinch hit him to try to get those runs home, and I know they were short in the bench that night too, then you got it. Then he's got to go two more innings. But he went one more inning, and that was weird to me. And it didn't really have a bearing on the game, but I think it speaks to a larger issue with the Mets and with baseball. Now, why aren't these guys being stretched out longer? If the Mets are having such problems covering innings, and it's not like it's a new phenomenon this year. This is something that they've had to deal with all year. So I don't understand why guys like Negosic and other guys that they have down there, like Robert Stock, you know, they come up and they're not being stretched out to go four, five, six innings. They're just expected to go three. I'm sure Stock was only expected to go three last night. So the whole thing probably only cost them two innings. But still, if you've got guys that can go a little deeper in the games, go and maybe it's an analytics thing. Maybe they don't want these guys going a second time into the lineup, where you don't want starters going through third time in the lineup. You don't want relievers, these kind of relievers, to go second time through the lineup. I get it. But I just don't know why we're not stretching these guys out in our system when we know that there's plenty of innings that are going to be filled with all these starting pitchers having injury issues like DeGrom and Peterson and God knows who else next, and Lucchese and Yamamoto and all these guys. So that's kind of that game presented a philosophical thing for me. They lost. Okay, I could deal with it. But yeah, I start to wonder, what can we do going forward to kind of coax more innings out of these guys?
Well said. Nice to see Pete Alonso continuing to hit the long ball. He hit number 19 in this game. So moving on, finally, to the road trip finale, I'll call it. Something just short of a masterpiece by Marcus Stroman. 8 innings, 1 hit, 1 walk, 7 strikeouts. He faces 26 batters. Jerry's Familia closes out the game with a scoreless 9th inning. No hits, no walks, 3 strikeouts. That's good stuff, man. Nice way to close out a little road trip. And again, something just short of a masterpiece. Rich.
So how often, if you're a Met fan, do you get exactly what you want? Not very, right, over all these years. Well, the Mets got exactly what they needed and what we as fans wanted in that game. What we needed was an easy win, and what the team needed was length out of their starting pitcher. Well, they got both of those. Like you said, Mike, Stroman was nothing short of outstanding. I don't know what you guys took of his next question comment to Mike Puma when Puma asked if he wanted to go out for the ninth. I'll take that as, yeah, he did, and he probably wasn't all that happy about being removed. But anyway, you may let you guys comment on that. But he was absolutely masterful. The Dom Smith grand slam, a VR who has been a hell of a pickup for this team, home run. The Dom Smith grand slam made it 5-0 early. You know, you get the Guillorme home run on there, only second of his career. So, and with the way, you know, while as Mets fans, and I'll speak for myself, I'm always looking up at the sky waiting for the safe to fall. In that game, you know, based on how dominant Stroman was, I had no doubt they were going to win it. It was a nice, comfortable, easy win. And it was a win that took the shape of exactly what they needed. Like I said, the bullpen got a chance to rest. They essentially get 2 days off other than Familia, who was outstanding. So, yeah, it was a nice way to end 5 previously wacky and sometimes draining games. So it was great. I mean, it was a really nice respite after the first 5 games.
Now, he exited the game with 90 pitches. We know entering this season, Stroman averaged less than 6 innings per start, 5.2 to be exact. So taking him out at this point, if you're the manager, I won't begrudge Luis Rojas for that. Could he have gone longer at 90 pitches? Yeah, I would say yes. So anywhere you want to pick this up, John?
I'll respond to that by saying I didn't mind the 8 innings. I love that he went 8 innings. I thought they needed 7. 8 innings was perfect. I think that it might have been a good idea to go with Diaz in the 9th just to get him on the hill and get him a good inning under his belt with the day off coming and going into the Toronto series. You know, Diaz isn't a guy you want to sit for a few days in a row. So I would have pitched Diaz. Now, yeah, that's a small thing. But other than that, listen, what Stroman did was exactly what the Mets needed. I thought Dom Smith's grand slam made it a little easier for Stroman to kind of settle in and just do what he does. And, you know, it also got me thinking about the way pitchers thought back in, like, the 70s as to the way pitchers thought now. You know, back in the 70s, if Stroman was pitching in the 70s, I think he would have gone into that game. I think what he would have been taught was, okay, I need this. I need to go deep in this game. I'm going to do whatever it takes to go deep in this game. And I think if Stroman didn't have the stuff that he had, he would have still tried to go deep into this game because the team needs it. I don't think teams and players and pitchers think like that anymore. I think they think more about process than results. And Stroman even said it in the post game. He said, well, I just went in just thinking I'm going to do what I do. But as the game was going on, he said he thought that, yes, I'm going to go as long as I can because the team needs me and I'm in a good groove and I'm getting the results from my process. So it was foremost in his mind, but I don't think it was foremost in his mind in the beginning. So I always think that that's fascinating to try to think how pitchers go into a game where they're really needed to go deep. What's their mindset now as opposed to what their mindset was then? But in any event, Stroman was excellent, exactly what they needed. Now, with the Puma thing, I thought that was interesting. I'm not sure that it was the question that he didn't appreciate. Because I watched the post game, and as soon – if you go back and watch that, and again, this is just me guessing. But as soon as the PR guy said, next up is Mike Puma, Stroman put his head down, and he seemed to disconnect. And then once the question was over, that's when Stroman picked his head up and said, next question. Now, for every other question, he seemed to look at the screen and be attentive to the question. I didn't think the question from Puma was bad. I think that this is something – I think that that it might be Stroman or the Mets having some sort of issue with Puma. That's the way I read it. I could be dead wrong on that, but it seemed to me that it wasn't the question that Stroman had an issue with, but it was the person asking the question. And I don't know why. I don't know if they have any sort of history. I don't know if Puma has ticked off the Mets before. He might have. I'm not sure on that, but I think it's one of those. It doesn't really have any bearing on the season, but it's just one of those things for the back of the Rolodex, you know?
I didn't pick up on that, Rich. Care to comment?
You know, I think John raised a fair point. I never thought of it that way. I never thought of it was a personal thing. The body language, as I'm playing it back in my head, he's right. You know, Stroman did look away from the Zoom, from the camera at that point, and look down when they said next question is from Mike Puma. You never know. I mean, Puma could have written something. I don't read the post, but, you know, Puma could have written something at some point about Stroman that he didn't like, and that very well could be the case. It very well could be that, you know, Stroman just didn't want to entertain Puma's question. Puma could have asked him what the weather was like, and he wouldn't have liked that either. I never thought of that. I think it's as viable of a possibility as anything else.
You're listening to the Metsian Podcast, and our guest this evening has been John Coppinger, a.k.a. Metsadamus. Gentlemen, the Mets coming back home. They'll be here shortly to take on the Toronto Blue Jays or the Buffalo Blue Jays, whichever way you want to call them, followed by that five-game series against the Braves and then another series against Cincinnati. The games against Cincinnati, I think, are very important, as are the games against the Braves. Don't get me wrong. But the games against Cincinnati, I think, are going to be very important. And I say that because when you look at the other divisions, you know, the West right now are being led by the Giants with 60 victories. L.A. has 59, San Diego 56. The wild card is more than most likely coming out of the Western Division, and I do mean both of them. Looks like the Mets are going to have to win this division outright if they are to make the postseason. Now, like I said, an 11-game homestand coming up, but the trade deadline is a week and a day away. Do the math. Mets have decisions to make. Now we have Jacob DeGrom, who's achy with the question mark. Today on the Michael Kay show, I heard him say that he talked to a doctor. It may have been Dr. Andrews, in which he said that, you know, Tommy John surgery, the expiration date on those are about 7 years. That puts Jacob DeGrom past expiration date. Perhaps this is what he's suffering. We don't know. I'm not a doctor. But the trade deadline is right around the corner, and the new caveat to the situation is no waivers. There are no more waivers. So whatever the Mets decide they need to do and execute during this deadline, that's the way it's going to remain throughout the regular season. And I'll pick that back up with you, John. What say you?
Well, the Mets have some decisions to make, don't they? I think that it's funny because that's a team that we all expected them to hit the lights out to start the season. And I don't think we expected as much from the pitching, nearly as much from the pitching as they've given us. And now you see, you know, were the last few games against Cincinnati a blip in the radar or the beginning of a trend or the beginning of a normalization trend where the hitters are finally going to hit up to expectations? And are the pitchers going to come down a little bit? Because they've set such a high standard this whole season. Are they going to normalize too? And I think that for the Mets to figure that out is tricky because you're going to have to make decisions based on the next 7 games or 8 games before the trading deadline and say, okay, what area are we going to shore up? Now, excuse me, I think the Mets are very good in all three facets of the game but could use improvement everywhere. I think they could use a bat. I think they could definitely use a starter, and I think they could use a reliever, especially if Diaz's struggles are going to be long-term this year. I'm not sure they are, but even if Diaz comes back, I think they could use another back-end piece, and you're looking at three possible, many possible ways it can go, but when you look at the Cubs, you see they have exactly what the Mets need. Another bat, a back-end reliever in Craig Kimbrel, and perhaps if they want to get a starter too, there's Kyle Hendricks. So the question is, how much are the Mets willing to pay in terms of money and prospects for all of these guys? And I know that there's other options. There's Jose Berrios in Minnesota, which would be a great option for the Mets to get. I think he's a high-end starter. I wouldn't put that past them. There's also Kyle Gibson in Texas. That could be another possibility. But if you want one-stop shopping, the Cubs might be the place to go. Now, I wouldn't pay too much for Chris Bryant and Durante. You're only going to have him for 2 months. I don't think the Mets are going to drop another $250 million on Bryant because they've got their own guys that they have to make decisions on in terms of DeGrom and Stroman and Syndergaard and Conforto. I don't think they want to add another one to the mix. So if the Mets are the team that gets Bryant, it's going to be a rental. Hence, I don't think they should pay all that much in prospects. Kimbrel is interesting because Kimbrel is the guy that gives you visions of Diaz. Whereas, are you going to pay that the rest of Kimbrel's salary, which is $16 million, or a buyout, and then the rest of this year's salary, which is probably like $5 million. Are you going to pay $21 million for a back-end closer and give the Cubs the prospect that they want for him? Because they want to make a Chapman deal in reverse. And then you got Kyle Hendricks, who I think personally is the guy they have to pay through the nose for. I don't think they should pay through the nose for Kimbrel or Bryant. I wouldn't mind having both of them, but Hendricks is the guy I think they would have to pay through the nose for. So what do if you're the Mets? Do you give up a prospect like Mauricio and take on all that salary to try and get all three? Or do you pay significantly less and just get Bryant and Kimbrel? Or do you just give up a lottery ticket for Bryant for 2 months and then go elsewhere for what you need. Some interesting decisions. I don't envy Zach Scott. I don't envy Sandy Alderson, because those are hard decisions to make. I think if they could wait till the deadline and get Bryan and Kimbrel for a reasonable price, I definitely do it, and then hope I can get an innings eater for the rotation elsewhere.
Rich, those are big ticket items. I will reiterate what I said at the beginning of the show, that the Mets allow the second least runs in the National League. However, they score the second least runs in the National League. We know they have pitching issues. There's a lot of guys in the DL. So, you know, after this last outing, Tawan Walker may be a question mark. Jacob DeGrom may be a question mark. But this is where I stand, Rich. I never expected or had the expectation that this organization would be turned around within the 9 months since Mr. Cohen took over. And I still feel like that. Rome was not built in a day. If that makes me overly patient, I'm okay with that. But I don't think we should be breaking the bank on some of these players, some of these bigger ticket items. If they come at a good cost, you know, everything's price worthy at the right cost. So I'm not averse to it, but I don't want to do too much. I'm not so sure if that satisfies Mets fans' aspirations. And if they don't, I'm sorry. But I just don't want to do too much, Rich. Take it away.
Well, you know, I've struggled with this too, Mike, and I don't want to do too much either. Now, obviously, everybody defines too much differently. But let me say this, and as I've wrestled with this in my head, sometimes you have to take something when it's in front of you. And what I mean by that is look at this year. The Braves are decimated in the rotation. Their bullpen stinks, and they've lost Acuña. The Phillies, their bullpen continues to be dreadful. They have good starting pitching. Their offense is inconsistent. They can hit the ball, but it's generally consistent. So where I'm going with this is the Nationals just lost Schwarber. Scherzer they may trade if they're sellers. So the ticket to the postseason can be punched this year. Who knows about next year or the year after that? You know, maybe the Mets get better next year or the year after that, but maybe the Braves get a lot better. I mean, they've already added a couple of pieces. Maybe the Braves get better. Maybe the Phillies figure it out. So I think I'm leaning toward when you have the opportunity, go for it, because you just don't know what might happen next year or the year after that or the year after that. Okay, with that said, the Mets will add, I don't know what they'll add, but here's how I view the trading deadline. I am not all about bringing in an offensive piece. You know, whether it's Chris Bryant, I agree with what John said. Why would you spend prospects for this guy who is going to – you're not going to re-sign him. He's going to go somewhere else because the Mets have to figure out their own house. They've got to figure out Syndergaard. They've got to figure out Conforto. They've got to figure out Jacob deGrom after 2022. I don't think that they would consider keeping Chris Bryant at his price. And by the way, J.D. Davis is no slouch. Jonathan Villar is no slouch. Now, granted, is Bryant an upgrade over those guys? Absolutely is. Is he worth spending a boatload of prospects on for a rental? I don't see it. I'd rather spend those prospects on a starter and a back-end reliever. So what I'm thinking, very aligned with John, is if the Cubs make Hendricks available or, you know, Gibson's available from the Rangers. I heard tonight on Baseball Night New York right before we came on that maybe Richard Rodriguez is available from the Pirates, their closer. That's where I want to focus. I want to focus on adding maybe one guy, if you could get this guy, who might be a three profile as a 3-4 starter, and maybe even somebody's swing man, you know, a good major league arm. So I want to add that. And if they could add Craig Kimbrel, for some reason in my mind, he's the number one. He's, to me, you give me Craig Kimbrel on this team, think about it. Think about all the blown saves in 2019. If we could have said, look, Diaz is in one of his pitching slumps. We're going to go to Kimbrel for a while. Or even if Kimbrel does the eighth, Diaz is the eighth, Kimbrel is the ninth. You have both those guys back there. When you have a lead, you're very likely going to win that game. And let's face it, guys, that is not the case right now. Look at Pittsburgh on Saturday night. Look at what happened in Cincinnati on Monday night. You know, if they could solve the back end of the game, that's huge. So if you could do that and add a decent 3-4 if possible, and maybe just somebody else is willing to give up, you know, like I said, maybe their swingman, just to have a major league arm, to me that would be an incredibly successful trading deadline. That's a lot. You know, Craig Kimbrell's not going to come cheaply. This 3-4 starter I'm talking about, not going to come cheaply. Maybe the swing man would. So if you think about what the Mets have to trade, well, I think you could certainly trade Ronnie Mauricio. You have Francisco Lindor for the next 10 seasons, you know? You don't really need a shortstop in your system at this point. You don't. So that's your number one trading piece. I would not give up any of the arms. I wouldn't give up Matt Allen or any of these guys, certainly any of the guys they drafted last year when they had a pretty decent draft, or 19 and 19, I should say. I would not give up any of these starting pitching arms they have, but I would think about a Mauricio. Might think about a Vientos as a chip that might be able to go. That's not a lot. Maybe you have to trade a little bit from your major league roster. You know, teams might be interested in young guys who are under control. I've heard Jeff McNeil's name mentioned going somewhere in the deal because they have team control on him. Who knows? But that's what I would do. So in summary, because the opportunity is there, I say take it. I don't mean ravage the farm system that is just starting to get its legs back under it. But you do have a couple of chips, and if you can turn those chips, you know, maybe you have to do a major league player, maybe you have to throw something like that in there, but you need a little help for that rotation, and if you could get me a Craig Kimbrell to make sure that we're not losing, that the Mets aren't losing games, that they have a lead in the eighth, ninth innings, because that's what championship teams don't do, I'd say do that. That's what I would do.
Very well said. I agree. Ronnie Mauricio is expendable because of Lindor and the length of his contract. And, you know, they have Britt Beatty and Vientos now at Double A. They have two third basemen there, even though they're playing Beatty in left field. But still, you know, one of them just may very well become expendable. The question is which. So, gentlemen, unless you have any outstanding issues, questions, comments, rude remarks, going once.
I have a question, actually.
Excellent.
And I was thinking about it as Rich was just going through the issues in the bullpen and that he would go get Craig Kimbrell. I want to put this to both of you. Who worries you more out of the bullpen? Is it Edwin Diaz or is it Seth Lugo?
Rich?
Huh. Diaz, and I'll tell you why. The reason I hesitate is I have confidence in Lugo. Yes, I know he didn't have his stuff on Saturday, and that wasn't good. But Lugo, I think, is generally reliable. You know, he has the four or five pitches. So the thing about that is, you know, if Diaz doesn't have the slider, which he didn't in a lot of 19, even though he throws 100 miles an hour, when they know it's coming, they can hit it. With Lugo, you've got 4 to 5 pitches. So if he can't find something, he could find something else in an outing. So I do have confidence in him. The reason I hesitated is the issue with Lugo is, you know, pitches, right? Number of pitches. If he pitches one night, you definitely don't have him the next night. And if he throws, you know, 20 pitches one night, you probably don't have him for two nights because of that ongoing issue with his elbow. So I worry about his reliability and the fact that, you know, if you get into the postseason and you have to play two games in a row, oh, can't use Lugo tonight, you know, because he threw 20 pitches the other night. But even with that said, I have more confidence in him than Diaz because I do think with Diaz, I don't dislike the guy, but I do think with Diaz, it's gotten in his head. They were talking about that on WFAN this morning. I do think the booing, some of the lack of success he's had, you know, the fact that even though he had a good run here in 21 for a while, it hasn't been what he saw in Seattle in 2018. So I do think it's in his head a bit. And I think when your closer has, you know, issues rattling around in his head and every now and then, guy throws two pitches. If he doesn't have one of them, he gets pounded. I don't know. While I still think he has incredibly dominant stuff, he worries me.
I'm pretty much right there with you, Rich. Thing with Diaz is, you know, if he can limit his appearances to, say, 15 pitches, he's very effective. But batters are figuring out that if you just wait him out and get his pitch count beyond 20, it becomes very easy to figure out, and that slider becomes very hittable. And it becomes a very predictable pitcher. That's what I picked up on him. Lugo, more crafty, more savvy. His durability is the question. So which is the lesser of two evils? I would have to agree with Rich. I'd stick with Lugo. Diaz, again, if he can limit his amount of pitches per appearance, he's effective. But once he gets in the high teens and enters the 20s, he becomes a very predictable thrower. And that's problematic. You know, just before the break, he had that game against the Pirates in which they brought him in the eighth inning, and he performed very effectively as the fireman in the eighth inning. But he wound up, you know, losing the game in the ninth or blowing it in the ninth. And I gave him props for what he did in the eighth inning, you know, and the ninth inning to me was what it was. But now he has three straight blown saves, and that's problematic. It's problematic. So instead of shining the spotlight on him as a closer, perhaps he's going to have to work in tandem with somebody else, perhaps somebody off campus, and, you know, just continually teaming him up with May. And, you know, let's give Jeremy's familiar his kadoos, because if we really think about it, where would we be without him this season? He's really come through for us. So I guess that's a long-winded way of saying that I have more confidence in Lugo at this point right now than I do Diaz.
How about you, John?
I think they both worry me, but because of what you said about the durability, Rich, I think Lugo does worry me. I mean, at least Diaz has had a really good stretch this year up until recently. I just think he needs to be used right, and by used right, I mean – don't let him sit for 3-4 days and then expect him to come back and be sharp that first day back. I think if you give him regular, and that's why I would have put him in the game on Thursday. I think if you give him regular work and keep him on a schedule, not on a schedule so much, but make sure that he hasn't gone 3, 4, 5 days in a row without pitching, I think he'll be fine. I think he can get those pitches working well, and I think he'll be okay. Lugo worries me, though, because he hasn't had that good stretch this year. He's coming off an injury. And like you said, with the durability, if he, you know, it was one thing when he was working, was pitching really well a couple of years ago, and it's like, okay, he gave you two really good innings, but you can't use him for another couple of games. Okay, but at least he gave you two good innings. If he comes in and has a bad inning, which is more than likely going to be 35, 40 pitches, then he gave you a bad outing, and then you don't have him for 2 days after that. So it's almost like that roster spot isn't giving you anything. So, and it worries me because Lugo can be such a Swiss Army knife out of that bullpen, but if he's not effective, then that limits what you can do with the rest of the bullpen. Diaz, you know what he is. He's a ninth inning guy, and if he can't get it done, you put somebody else in the ninth inning. But if Lugo can't do what he does, then that's a lot of options that you've lost. So I think for those reasons, Lugo actually worries me more than Diaz, believe it or not.
And you know what? This is an instance where managers actually matter. It's going to matter how Luis Rojas manipulates Lugo, Diaz, and Trevor May together as a trio. He has to interweave these guys to bring them all, to elevate all their games. This is not going to be an individual effort on Lugo, Diaz, or even May's part. Luis Rojas needs to come up with the formula in how to interweave these three in order to get these three up to standard, playoff standard. Anybody want to react to that before we wrap it up?
I would just say don't. I think that's a very good point. I don't know if I have the confidence in Rojas to do that. I'll keep my fingers crossed. But the other thing with Rojas is, don't play paint by numbers. If something's not working, don't try to see it through to the end like you did with Lugo in that Saturday game against the Pirates. If something's not working, you can get away from the plan. You can throw Aaron Loop in there in the eighth inning if Lugo doesn't have it for you. You can throw Familia in the ninth if it's apparent that Diaz doesn't have it. And if Trevor May doesn't have it, then you go from there. But don't try to ram May in the seventh, Lugo in the eighth, Diaz in the ninth, if if it's apparent that one of those pitchers is off.
So, Rich, we'll make this our final point. Luis Rojas, will he meet the challenge over the next – through the dog days of summer and through September?
I think so. I think Rojas, you know, he's a stock portfolio like anybody. He has his ups and he has the things that are down, but I think you have to look at the net, and I think on net he's very good. He absolutely drives me insane with exactly what John just said. It seems like he doesn't disaster plan. Like, in other words, okay, look, tell me, you know, if you, what you guys think of this. I could tell in the first one or two pitches if Diaz is going to be good Edwin or bad Edwin. Because if he throws that first pitch and it misses by a mile, it's like, uh-oh. You know, you could always tell with him early on. So what I've never understood is if it looks like Diaz is struggling, and again, at least my observation is Diaz, he telegraphs it, you know. Like Keith would say, he Western Unions it. You know right away this guy, you could pretty much tell. So get somebody behind him. Yes, I know pitch counts. You can't use the same guys every day. I know that stuff, right? But on the other hand, if Diaz is in the game, very likely it's the same situation. It's a game that's winnable. It's in your hand to win. If you see he's struggling, sometimes you wonder, whether it's Diaz or anybody else, but we'll focus on Diaz, you wonder, how can he not see what we're seeing? How can he have no one up and throwing? No one. Even if Lugo, who's probably your second best reliever in May, even if they're not, neither is available, have Loop throwing. Have Drew Smith throwing. You could see with this guy, he doesn't implode all at once. You could see it right away. At least I can. Tell me what you think. But that would be my thing with Rojas is, yes, they criticize Girardi for bullpen management. Everybody's criticized for bullpen management. But to me, with Louis, it's more the obvious. Like, how can you go with this guy this long? How did you not see what we saw? So that's the thing. But having said that, it's obvious the team loves him. It's obvious that that they play hard for him. He's well prepared. He's obviously a baseball savant. You know, it's in his blood, and he knows the game very well. So other than that bullpen thing I just mentioned, I think his portfolio, his stock line points up. And I do think I think if they don't win the division, I don't think it'll be a Luis Rojas thing. I don't.
Yeah, I love the way you put it. He doesn't disaster plan well. That's great. John, thank you so very much for joining us again this evening. We love having you on. I want you to take another minute out. Tell us what you're doing. Tell us where we can find it. And please go right into your final word. You know how this works.
Well, absolutely. And thank you guys for having me on again. I love being on and talking with you guys, and I'm ready. Anytime I can do it, I will, for sure. You guys can all find me on MetroDomusBlog.com. You can find me on the Burger Ball podcast when it's time to get a new one out there. And you can find me on the Sports Talk New York app on the Alexa, and I whisper that. Download that app, and you can see it. You can hear us every Sunday at 6 p.m. with Mark Roseman and AJ Carter. I'm the first 5 minutes, so come one, come all, and then every once in a while I'm here. So that's what I got to plug. And again, thank you guys so much for having me on. I enjoy it every time I do this, and I can't wait for the next time.
And your final word, sir. John?
Oh, my final words. I'm here. My final words, let's see. I believe that J.D. Davis's performance over the next couple of weeks is going to prove to be extremely important for this team. I think it's going to decide how they go into negotiations for a guy like Chris Bryant. I don't think that him playing well and hitting well is going to mean that they're not going to get Chris Bryant. To the contrary, I think that him playing well will lessen the need for Bryant, which means that the Mets have the upper hand in negotiations. If Davis slumps, the Mets could be more desperate for a bat. And I don't necessarily believe that Davis has to be in a deal for Bryant. I think they can get away with it with a decent prospect. and then they can, and then Brian can play some right field, some left field if they don't, if they want to have a lineup that'll terrorize left-handers. You sit Smith for a day, you sit Conforto for a day, and have Brian and Davis on the field at the same time, and then you can mix and match. So, but it really all depends on what Davis does over the next 2 weeks. I have confidence that he's going to scald the ball, and I think that a deal for Brian after that is going to be reasonable. But that's what I think.
Rich, give us another shameless plug and your final word.
All right, thanks, Mike. Mesmerized is where you can find my writing, and of course here with you guys on the Metsian podcast. So my final word would be two words: what's next? Question mark. Because with this team, they're kind of unpredictable, you know, with the injuries and the up and down nature of the whole thing. I don't know what's next for this team. So, and here's specifically what I mean: they've got the Braves coming up for 5 games. Who will pitch those games? Will they go off campus, as you like to say, Mike, and bring in some arms? Or will they try to ride it out with what they have? Because right now, we only know Marcus Stroman will pitch in that series. We don't know who the hell else is going to pitch. And maybe McGill will get one of maybe the Thursday game. But how are they going to approach all this? What is next for this team? Are they going to buy now and bulk up before the deadline and be ready? Are they going to make small moves and try to ride out what they have? Well, what's next with the Grom? I just think with this team, there's so much that we don't know. They've been so unpredictable. So that's my final word. What's next?
Very interesting. My final word, my final thought, Atlanta, these next 5 games against them, it's imperative that the Mets keep them down. Because those 13 games we got coming up against L.A. and San Francisco in August come after the deadline. And those 13 games, Rich and John, I feel, are going to make or break this Mets season. And that's why I feel it's extremely imperative that the Mets keep Atlanta down. That opportunity is right around the corner. Seize the moment. And that's my final word. Again, John Carpenter, everyone, thank you so very much for joining us on the Metsian Podcast this evening, my partner Rich. And on behalf of our partner Sam Maxwell, who was unavailable this evening, we thank you for joining us on another episode of the Metsian Podcast. We hope to speak to you again next week with good news, more good news than bad, hopefully. And until then, let's go Mets, everybody. Good night.
Let's
Have a
go
great
Mets.
Night.
Good night, all.